Our speaker this afternoon is Eileen Shanahan, Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, a native of Washington and George Washington University graduate. She is a previous reporter for the New York Times, and I guess most of us had heard about her in that role. She was in the Washington Bureau. She has also reported for various other publications and was a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs in the Department of Treasury earlier, so she is not new to the government and definitely not new to Washington. She lectures at the University of California at Berkeley in the Minorities in Journalism program, a member of various organizations and holder of several appointed positions. I am sure you look forward to hear from Ms. Shanahan. Welcome.
I see a few old friends in the audience, but mostly people I don't know. It seemed appropriate to me perhaps to start off by answering for everyone the question my old friends ask me as someone who has not only changed jobs, but in a certain sense changed careers, at least temporarily, in the last 10 months. It's a question I don't think men ask each other when a man has a new job. A man might ask another man, how's it going? What's the boss like? Something like that. My old friends, without fail, always ask me, are you happy? Yes, I'm happy to be able to say. I'm happy because I'm doing new things and thinking about things in new and different ways. Even though I spent a lifetime in Washington, I discover I'm thinking about government and institutional relationships and things like that in different ways that I never did before. And with a sense of personal growth, the pace is unsatisfying, but it's still there. Yes, I'm happy. I'm a little concerned about this speech, not to make a speech, which I've done a lot of times, but about the question period. There are 351 statutorily mandated programs in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and then the other day, about 8:30 in the evening, with the inbox still like that, I, in deep, dark despair, sat down and made a list of how many I knew, well, at least that much about. And it came to 32, which any fool can plainly see isn't even 10%. I think if I stay the course for 4 years, I'll be very lucky to know about perhaps 150. I did bring with me my telephone number list of information officers in Department of HEW, and if you ask me any program questions, I'm liable to say, well, I don't know, but let me give you a number of somebody who might. Now, what I'm going to talk about is not, in fact, specifically related to women's issues, except as I hold to the view that all humanitarian issues are women's issues, but about the only thing I know anything about nowadays, which is a view from the inside of the government, and in a certain sense, of the nation. I've asked myself a little bit in recent months, looking at budgetary constraints on the welfare program, for example, what am I doing here? A radical spender, old-fashioned Democrat, by which I mean someone who believes in government and in government spending as an instrument of change and progress. And I do believe in that. It's my sad conclusion that I reached very swiftly after the beginning of my own government service, which coincided with the beginning of the Carter administration, that the mood of the country is very mean and penurious. I think President Carter has the mood right when he emphasizes as much as he does budget balancing, even though that target may not be met. I'm sorry he's got it right, because I wish the mood were otherwise. But I think it's there, and I'm not the slightest bit happy to tell you that. So what can we do, we in government, in the face of a nation that is in no mood to add to the resources that it is giving the government to spend for the poor, for what any of us might agree we would define as progress. My answer is a strange one for a self-admitted, radical, big-spending Democrat. We have to be managers. We have to manage these programs. We have to show the American people that we have an infinite respect for every penny we get from the tax system for the support of these programs before they're going to give us a penny more. And I'd like to take a little side journey for any of you in the room who are Republicans or at least non-Democrats and say that in my years as a reporter, I never considered myself a terribly partisan person, and in a sense I still don't. Certainly as a journalist, I always had many Republican friends, and if I were making a list of the public officials I had most enjoyed knowing and covering, there'd be a lot of Republican names on that list. But I've been absolutely astounded since I've been inside of HEW to discover that the Republicans who I thought were managing, they weren't innovating new programs. That was a matter of belief. They shift believing what they believe. They shouldn't have been innovating new programs. That's fine. But they weren't managing either. We have, every time I get together, not only with other officials in HEW, but with those I know in other departments, which is a great many with my long years in Washington, and it's also the Women's Network. We know each other. I know women at the top in very nearly every single government department. We all say the same things. Isn't it incredible? Every system for controlling the way money is spent had fallen into complete disuse under the Republicans, and in its place had grown up little independent principalities, which just kind of went ahead, hell-bent, and did anything they pleased. I uncovered something the other day, maybe a case of fraud, I don't know. If it is, we'll turn it over to the right authorities, where someone, I think, if I have the facts right, and I'm still looking into it, was given a contract for $100,000 to write a book on the history of a particular disease. And if it was just for writing the book, I think it may have been fraud. And the person was who got the contract was a former employee of the agency awarding the contract. Well, I don't want to prejudge that case. But perhaps the interesting and appalling part of it is that my office is supposed to have clearance on any such grant, and it was never cleared through my office. And I'm eternally finding right in my own public affairs shop, where I have responsibility for reviewing publications, audiovisual materials, TV programs, etc., that the department either pays for entirely or subsidizes in part, that what it says right there in the manual in plain English about the authority of my office to review at the clearance, the concept clearance stage, and at several other stages further down the line had fallen totally into misuse. We're trying to reestablish those procedures, not without quite a lot of resistance from the independent principalities. Of course, we'd all prefer to be innovating new programs. And there will be some. But I think one of the key, the second key point I want to make about what we in government have to do in the face of the penurious mood of the country is we have to innovate carefully. It has interested me to discover the extent to which that concept is shared. I thought I had arrived at all by myself in a stroke of utter brilliance before I ever went into the department, uniquely having concluded that the world was different with my own conception of where the future world would be, only to discover, taken absolutely as a given by all of my colleagues in HEW and all of my friends and former associates in other departments. The recognition that all wisdom does not reside in Washington is a key aspect of innovating carefully. The Great Society, of which I will have more and something affirmative to say in a minute, I think, did not understand that. The Great Society preceded by the Kennedy administration, which had the same defect and for a variety of reasons didn't produce the same programs, might have if it had lasted, if Kennedy hadn't been killed. The concept there was that you assembled the greatest brains in Washington, and they sat down and thought about these great subjects and brought all their expertise and their brilliance to them, and a program was born. We know better now. I think throughout the government we know better now. We know that all wisdom does not reside in Washington, and that there has to be an interaction with the people who will be administering the program out across the country and with the people who will be the recipients of the programs out across the country if they are to succeed, if they are to, in fact, be sound in concept at all. A lot of that is going on. I've been a little surprised that it hasn't gotten more publicity, though it has locally in some places. Right off the bat, back in the spring, we didn't do it terribly well because we did it very fast. HEW held hearings, at least one hearing in each of the 50 states on the welfare reform program, getting the views of welfare recipients, administrators, advocacy groups, and any just plain old citizen who wanted to walk in off the street as to what the welfare program should be. I don't think there's the slightest doubt. I know there isn't the slightest doubt that that program is a better, sounder program than it would have been if we hadn't gone to the trouble of finding out what the people thought about it. I was amused and interested in several other things. Califano himself chaired one whole day's hearing, sat there in his shirt sleeves for 10.5 hours in Washington where people came in to talk about what they thought ought to be in the welfare program. I dropped in and out 3 or 4 times during the day. I couldn't stay, but I was waiting for him in his office when he got back. And the first thing he said was, boy, there isn't going to be enough scotch in the world tonight. But the second thing, then I said to him, tell me, what do you know now that you didn't know 10.5 hours ago? And he said, what a rip-off the WIN program is. Those dead-end jobs, it's terrible. We ought to do more. We ought to do something not to make those dead-end jobs. There was something about seeing those women themselves talk about those jobs that had a tremendous impact on him that all of the scholarly studies in the world wouldn't have. And this is the sort of thing that is going on in other areas as well, and I hope influencing other policymakers as well. We are doing the same thing now, just finished doing it, much better because we had a little more time to plan it, on national health insurance. There have been hearings, at least one per state in each of the 50 states, and I've been reading some of the coverage from around the country. The level of participation varied a lot, although we did a lot of publicizing. But it is clear that a lot of ideas got across, and I'll have to tell you Califano's story about that, too. It's off the record, Grayson. What's your name? But any other reporters that are present, there's no real reason why it should be, I suppose. But there again, after it was over, I said to Califano, he also conducted a hearing in Washington, I said, okay, what do you know now that you didn't know at 8:30 this morning? He said, boy, do the nurses hate the docs. And then went on with a level of sophistication that he really had acquired in that setting of how nurses know and believe and know and feel certain and are, you could see, accepted the idea is sound, that they could do a hell of a lot more than the doctors let them. And I don't know that he could articulate it, but I got a sense that he really understood it wasn't just a matter of the money. It was a matter of power and authority, and that the doctors wouldn't let the nurses do any number of things that they are perfectly capable of doing because they want to remain as the godly figures and keep the nurses as peasants. He wouldn't put it that way even now, I'm sure, but I had a sense that that thought came through. If those thoughts come through to our highest policymakers as a matter of going across the country and listening to the people, I think that's good. I also think it's necessary. We can record. I was talking about the things that we in government have to do in the face of the mean spirit of the American people at the moment. And the first I said was manage, and the second I said was, you know, vague carefully. There's a third one that doesn't make me terribly happy to tell you either. And that is really attack, fraud, and abuse that is causing a waste of government dollars. I am not the least bit happy to tell you that I have concluded that there really is a lot more fraud, a lot more ripping off of the taxpayer dollar than I had ever thought. I am not the slightest happy to tell you that I think there is a lot of welfare fraud. I spent my life inveighing against the hateful people who were saying that, who I think really didn't give a damn about the poor and wanted to believe that people were buying steaks and driving Cadillacs on welfare. Well, when I say that there is, I am afraid, more welfare fraud than I had wanted to know, admit, or recognize, I don't mean people are driving Cadillacs and eating steaks on welfare. That is nonsense. They are getting $100, maybe more than they're entitled to. But I do think we have to come to grips with this, and I must say that since I've been thinking about it, I do discover that my black friends are quicker than my white to focus in on the fact that those who are defrauding welfare are hurting the people who need welfare. And therefore, I do think it is something, however unattractive and unpleasant, however much we hate the people who've been saying all these years that there's welfare fraud, I'm afraid that we are going to have to concede it and try to root it out if, in fact, we are going to get public and political acceptance of any improvement in the welfare system. And I'm not the least bit happy to be telling you that. But I think it's something that has to be said if we are really going to turn the welfare program, improve it, and make of it something that helps the people who need the help. The stuff we have run into is really remarkable, stuff that has to be fraud. The number of people who are on the welfare rolls in both Philadelphia and New Jersey, for example, with the same name, the same Social Security number. They have to know they're defrauding the system. That can't be accidental. I don't mean to denounce these people. I'm not happy with a single word that's coming out of my mouth. But I think we have to face it. Of course, I'd started with welfare because that was the part I didn't want to say, so I'd get it over with. There's lots of other fraud. The docs are defrauding us like crazy in welfare. In Medicare and Medicaid. And, of course, there is an attack on that. The guaranteed student loan program. The fraud in that, unfortunately, is something the American people don't understand properly. They think that it's raunchy hippie kids who went to Yale who aren't paying their bills back. By and large, that is not the case. The problem in the guaranteed student loan program is not, for the most part, of young people who went to four-year colleges. It's or even junior colleges. It's a problem involving vocational schools, and to a degree that we aren't sure of yet, it's not the kids who are to blame. It is the fact that many of these schools are fly-by-night, absolutely fraudulent schools who give nothing of educational or vocational value whatsoever, and then when the kid doesn't pay off the loan, I suggest that it's not the kid who's defrauding the government. That's not 100% of the case. For example, in dollar terms, 59% of the guaranteed student loans do go to kids who are going to four-year colleges. 28% of the defaults are kids who went to four-year colleges. So I'm not saying there's none in that area. 28% of several billion is a lot of money. But I hope the American people are going to understand a little better than they do, and I'm not quite sure what the bias is that has filtered the wrong information through here to make people think that it's the kids who went not only to four-year colleges but to prestige four-year colleges. But it is something we plainly have to attack very seriously, and I think you're going to see some prosecutions of the fraudulent fly-by-night vocational schools, which, it will surprise nobody in this room, have a heavy emphasis on ripping off women. A very large number of the fraudulent, largest single category of the fraudulent vocational schools are schools of cosmetology. The next largest is computer programming that's just doesn't really teach you anything you can get a job with. There's one happy thing to say about fraud, and that is this. For all of us, some of you know, I come out of the economics area and the federal budget, and all the years I covered the federal budget, I didn't really believe that there was much that you could do by way of regaining government tax resources by eliminating waste. I now think there is. I now think the matter of total lack of management and of fraud is something that will save billions. And that's the happiest message I have for you. But the attack on it is going to be difficult. Everyone will have a vested interest in not permitting that attack to succeed. Not just people who are outright rip-off artists, but some of you who get grants, maybe, for projects that a rational person might think weren't the top priority use of the government money. I've seen a lot of grants that, even with my sympathetic eye toward study in the social policy area, I have a lot of questions about. And I've seen some that were outright ripoffs, too. I stopped one dead on my desk the other day that I didn't know a single thing about except one thing. It was a study of who listens to the children's programs on public television. Okay, that's something worth knowing. But one of the items in the study had to do with contour mapping where the signals of public television stations are received. Well, anybody who was ever anywhere near broadcasting knows that that is all done every 3 years when television station licenses are renewed. It is a matter of public record available in any public library in the TV fact book. Yet it was an element in this proposal. So I stopped the whole thing. I said, I know that one's a fraud. I don't know anything about the subject. I don't know anything else. But this is a ripoff, and I bounced it back. Those things are going on. It really is a more fraud-prone society than I had ever thought. Not a happy message. I'm sorry. Okay. Those are the things, though, that I think people in government have got to do. Manage, be very careful about new programs, and really attack fraud and waste. What can people outside of government do? So far, I perceive two things. Neither one of them easy, and neither one of them non-controversial. I want to talk to you for a moment about civil service reform, fully recognizing that there's quite a few civil servants in this room, an awful lot of whom work for my department, who I guess maybe came because they were interested in seeing some of the women at the top of the department. Here's another case. Maybe I ought to start by saying I'm the daughter of a career civil servant. That's how come I grew up in Washington. Everything any reactionary ever said about civil service, it's true. I have three people in my office who are grade 15s making in excess of $40,000 a year who don't do an hour and a half's work a day. It offends me. It enrages me. And yet, when I go to my very best career people, and I have some of those too, let there be no mistake about it, and I say, what am I going to do? They say, you're not going to live long enough to fire them. The civil service system is such, it seems to be kind of a litany, a rule of thumb, that if you want to try and fire somebody with all the procedures that are built in against it, it takes half your time for 2 years. And who that's trying to accomplish anything has got half their time for 2 years? Well, I think there is going to be some disposition to change that. Alan Campbell, the chairman of the Civil Service Commission, has been charged by President Carter with looking at every aspect of the civil service. And I don't know yet, because they're not completed yet, as far as I know, exactly what his recommendations are going to be. But he has made some speeches and made some specific suggestions, and every one of them sounds very sensible to me. And my purpose here is to enlist your support, even sight unseen, I will say, for whatever comes out, because I think it's going to be hard to get through Congress. One of the things which is of particular interest to women, not large numbers of whom are veterans, is the attack that will be made on veterans' preference. It is really the height of nonsense when I am trying to fill a grade 13 or 14 job, a very high-level professional job, and I, it's a regular civil service job, so I have to go through the nonpartisan recruiting procedure for that, advertise the job, that is, have it printed that the job is available, and then qualified people bid on it. A veteran, or by the simple fact that he is a veteran, who's 50 years old, who fought in World War II, who has had heaven knows how many jobs since then, automatically goes to the head of the list, and I can't put any other person that I might want to put into that job into it because of veterans' preference. It's nonsense. The concept Campbell had, which I understand is already being watered down, the concept he had, which struck me as quite rational, was to let veterans' preference be a once-in-a-lifetime thing that you could exercise at any time within 5 years of the time you left service, and once as a way of paying you back for the years you spent in service, you would go to the head of the list, and that would be all. That seems to me fair and rational and something that would, beyond question, improve the quality of the civil service. I think it would be hard as hell to get through Congress. I think it's going to take all kinds of lobbying to get it through. And I think every one of you has got to pay attention to the civil service reform and try to get it through. If I come back to my basic premise, if, like me, you were someone who would like to see the government spend more money on the kinds of things you'd like to see it spend money on, and therefore you do have to attack waste and inefficiency and participate in that, and civil service reform, I think, is absolutely crucial. Let me tell you what happens. Those of you who've never been in a civil service situation, you get somebody who can't do the job. You can't fire him. You layer him. Famous word. Everybody knows what you mean in government when you say layer him. And it means put somebody else in the same job, what amounts to the same job. And then, of course, somebody spends 2 days writing a phony job description so it doesn't look like the same job, another little piece of waste. And so you're getting two people at the same pay levels, one of whom is doing the job and one of whom is not. And I don't know how much money is wasted. I know that those three people in my office making in excess of $40,000 a year who aren't turning in an hour and a half's work a day in my own immediate office, their pay represents something, 4, 3, 2, 12, yeah, represents something close to 10% of the budget of the immediate office of the assistant secretary. What I could do if I could just get rid of those three people. I'd probably replace them with only two if I had two who would work. It has got to be considered. I'm not comfortable telling you any of this. I know I sound just like everybody I hated all my life. But it's true, and it has to be dealt with. And I'm inclined now to think that just as Nixon could go to China, maybe it's only Democrats who can really launch an attack on fraud and on the horrors of the civil service system. The other big thing where I would like to enlist your help in terms of getting us back to the point where the taxpayers will permit the government to do what I would like to see the government do for change and progress. I think a reassessment of the cliche that the Great Society was a complete failure is very much in order. The Great Society was not a complete failure. Parts of it were done poorly. There were things like, say, Head Start, which plainly did exactly what they were supposed to do.